So we have managed to connect again. We were trying to connect a ways back, and it was very, very challenging. And I'm glad that we've gotten another opportunity to get on the line. We've been following your broadcasts very closely.
Good, thank you.
What we really wish to talk about the most and think together about how we can encourage more others to be involved in this conversation is how trafficking co-optation is occurring across medical environments. The individuals and families in our network have been screaming or begging or, so many different trying to get responses about the fact that we have not been safe in medical environments, the fact that we get put right back into the hands of traffickers if we are put in medical environments, whether that is consenting or not consenting. And so we have this whole different language of what healthcare is because we know about the trafficking co-optation. And one of the ways that we wanted to start was by asking you for some of your stories about what you have encountered about people at these intersections not being safe in medical environments.
Well, there's a long history. I've been initially with doing street ministry in Vancouver 30 years ago, encountering a lot of that medical genocide, past and present, going on. A lot with Native people, the Indigenous people across Canada, and then over across America when I broadened my work and in Europe. And you find the same thing. It's like anything in this culture. It's a big for-profit industry involving human and organ trafficking and child trafficking at a massive level. And the people, as you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know already, but you're targeted. Anyone who complains about it or tries to investigate is someone who gets targeted in a big way. Now, in the last number of years, as part of our movement to set up a sovereign republic, we've tried to set up health practitioners who are out of the system already, try to set up our own alternative medical system. The people who try to do that is, like doctors who, try to prescribe alternative medicines and cures to cancer and all that, they get immediately taken down. And so we've learned to kind of operate very much off the radar and not even talk about it publicly, just set up the alternatives. And I think that that's from experience, like anyone's experience who gets targeted, they know very much that you've got to be very wise in how you go about things, right? So, I mean, we had an example just a few years ago of some of our witnesses who were killed in the hospitals in Vancouver through lethal injection, through arsenic poisoning, disguised as tuberculosis. All of that. There's a whole procedure. It's the other th another thing I found out in Vancouver was when young women in the Catholic Church get pregnant, they're immediately targeted by the baby adoption and trafficking industry. There's even a protocol in hospitals in Canada called BFA, Baby for Adoption. So as soon as a woman gets young girl gets pregnant, she's put in these homes that are run by the Catholic Church, and they give her all sorts of drugs, lactation suppressants. They basically brainwash them to want to give up their child, and the baby is then trafficked. So in utero, the baby is already being sold, and there's a big list of families who want babies, obviously, but for experimental purposes, for organ trafficking, ritual killing. The whole gamut, right? And there's a, there's a big market for that. It's the Catholic Church provides, they have a quota they have to fill every year of babies they need to provide. So the thing is that involves social workers, police, judges, hospital administrators, doctors. At every level, it's coordinated. It's well organized. And a woman who took part in that, Hannah Anderson, she. And you get that our biggest enemy is our own naivety. I urged her to go public when she came about 5 years ago. She came to me with what had happened to her, in a care home that was called the Maywood Home in Vancouver, still run by the Catholic Church. I said, look, you've got to go public right away. And she said, no, we're going to go through the courts and try to sue them. The minute she tried that, the lawyer, of course, got together with the Catholic Church, shut the whole thing down, silenced her. I had never heard from her after that. So it's that naivety of thinking there's somebody or something in the system you can appeal to. And that's one of our biggest problems we get around or try to get around, right? So that's some examples.
One of the things that we bring up a lot is when there is targeting for violence going on that depends upon mischaracterized neurological injury. So people are being neurologically injured in all of these ways that traffickers know very well how they work, but there is a lot of misinformation in systems and in professional networks and in community spaces about what a person's behavior may mean as regards neurological injury. And so when you talk about the courts and social work and social support systems, like all of these different professional contexts where people think, well, these people are here to help. Like someone in distress is going to encounter people who want to help. Mm-hmm. And what is encountered is, among other things, so much misinformation about neurological injury, so that we who are neurologically injured, especially in certain ways, come into contact with helping professionals who think something else is going on, and we are forced to educate them every step of the way. And so that makes it very easy for perpetrators to catch intersectionalized people who are trying to go through any process that we in our society think is a legitimate process needs to be examined in the context of trafficking pathways, because we know where the trafficking is occurring. We also know which systems and which communities are not listening to survivors of this kind of violence. And we can speak other language of it. So like you speak a particular language of it, you're very direct in your languaging. And then there are a lot of other languages that people are using to talk about this. It's just they don't necessarily recognize one another when they're talking about it. But in all of those cases, it's been very difficult for people to really listen to what survivors of violence are saying, because when we really listen, we find out exactly what's going on. And it's very easy and safe to do something about it just by being present with it, because it wouldn't be occurring if people were present with it, if there was anyone else there when that is going on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've talked before about how difficult your situation is for that reason, you know. And even people who are involved in issues of trafficking and genocide and all this stuff, they're not even aware of what you're talking about, because it's almost a taboo. It's kind of like ritual killing of children. It's a totally taboo subject that even, quote, activists don't want to look at, right? And then makes those people be able to be preyed on all the more. So I think that that's analogous to what you're talking about, right?
There have been a lot of stories that you have told in other interviews on different podcasts. We've been doing searches on people's names in the podcast index and finding all of the interviews that somebody has done on all of these different podcasts. And one of the first things that caused us to prioritize tuning in to what you were broadcasting on YouTube and through BBS Radio was the stories of individuals just striving to speak up about the basic situations, and finding there were already some kind of policy was already in place that it was like a net to catch them with before they would get very far. And there's this sort of Alice in Wonderland thing, like many of us were living in normative mainstreamish kinds of ways before we encountered very severe hardship, violence, different actions of trafficking networks going on. And so like suddenly the world gets flipped. And that's another thing that caused us to really tune into what you were saying, is when you talk about your life experience, being navigating sort of normative pathways, and then suddenly like your desire to say something that is right with you in your soul, in your spirit, like your sense of honor comes up against this invisible compromise that's being made in all of these environments, to discover that it is so pervasive is really shocking. And people end up processing it in isolation. So like the way that you've talked about that also has been really meaningful to us.
Well, good. And, you know, I see also another connection. The groups that are the most vulnerable, the system creates a controlled opposition, if you like, right? They create official organizations that spin the issue away from the real perpetrators and issue onto something more benign and manageable by the killers. And I found that in the Native world in Ireland, when I was working there with survivors of Catholic Church crimes, they had official survivors organizations and then the unofficial ones. The official ones got the government money. They would sit there at the press conferences with the church and government and say the right thing. They would talk about healing and reconciliation and not wanting to sue anybody and working things out, you know, whereas the real survivors over here are underfunded. They're never reported in the media. They're attacked as conspiracy theorists. They're infiltrated and disrupted and just wiped out. Right. So I don't know if that jives with your experience, but I think that especially people in your situation are like that. And so I don't know what controlled opposition is being attempted on your issue, but I think it's inevitable at some point, right?
We're tracking what's happening in a lot of different ways across the network. And there are so many of them. It's still really challenging for us to figure out like, which one are we talking about right now? We do a lot of, I personally, and like in other contexts with different groups, we really are taking cues from whoever is having a conversation that will include us, rather than, I mean, there's so much violent exclusion going on that people don't realize is violent exclusion. And so when we find people who are being decent to us and not pushing us out actively, then we really listen, like, what language are they using? Which words are they using to reference these things? Because this is a network of people really vastly affected by severe trauma that results in, I mean, I don't know how I want to talk about multiplicity, but many people who have studied trafficking intersections know that multiplicity comes out of trauma in particular ways. People become fragmented. People are fragmented on purpose and entrained in particular ways. And so it's sort of challenging to talk about it, but we are having experiences that are very, very complex and very, very sensitive to tiny detail in all of these really complex and comprehensive sorts of ways. And so when we're having to track all that different languaging and not be sure whether we're safe in a particular context because people haven't been willing to have the conversations that would actually make us safe, it makes it so difficult to verbalize a specific thing or to focus on a specific language, because we know that in a moment we might have to pivot and be able to speak this completely different frame in order to protect ourselves from people who would misunderstand, for instance, what you're saying. And there aren't just two, at least not just a binary. There are zillions of them. And people who are in environments that are in training them toward conflict, there's a Tower of Babel thing about it. I don't know how much sense that makes for your experience.
Oh yeah, I think so. But could you define what you mean by multiplicity?
This is a subject of particular trauma for me, but I'm okay, and I'm going to talk about it. But I don't know what'll come out of my face, so I'm glad we're recording. Labeling, psychiatric labeling is, and many people embrace the labels. I have a lot of difficulty with them. DID and multiple personality disorder are some that have been used. The multiple individuals that I have known tend to like to say multiple systems. I am a multiple system, one of us might say. Others have very different ways of saying it. There is a lot of psychiatric weaponization around. This is very hard for me because the last time I really talked about this in detail, I had not come through as much research on the kinds of trafficking that I had not personally experienced, that I learned more about how others had experienced. And that gave me a context to the way these psychiatric labels are being used that I haven't really gotten very verbal about yet, but that gives you more of what I meant anyway.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm getting that. Okay. Thanks.
We're holding a lot that really needs to be shared in community with others who, for instance, want to make sure that their healthcare contexts are actually safe, respectful, honorable care. Yep. Contexts. And you have experiences that if you feel like you want to bring up, I welcome you to, but we can talk about so many others also, where people are navigating more and more severe health conditions for various reasons, whether they're being targeted by traffickers as we have been, or, you know, any kind of thing. And if our care contexts are places that vulnerable people stay away from and scream are not safe, how, you know, we want to help people find the courage to say, oh, I don't want to go for care to a place that is causing right. that kind of damage.
Well, I think we have to put it in a bigger context too, because the so-called healthcare system has become completely politicized by COVID, which of course, COVID to me is an agenda. It has nothing to do with health, even the medical industry. And people have their own interpretation. And I think there's lots of truth in the different interpretations about it being bioweaponry. It certainly is familiar in terms of the years of interviews and research I've done into the psychiatric warfare being done on children who are institutionalized and Indian hospitals, residential schools, psychiatric facilities. I mean, we know after World War II and all the Nazi researchers who came over that, and that was a big purpose of MKUltra, find effective means of mind control. And I think it's evident now. And when you see 90% of people lining up for the shot, right? They know decades ago, centuries ago even, that people are most willing to relinquish their limited freedom they have over a health crisis, over something that is threatening in, or they are being told is threatening their life. And it doesn't have to make rational sense. It's not a rational process. It's fear-based reaction, right? So it's especially hard now in the COVID environment for anyone to rely on any health facility or any, you know, people have got to go their own way and invent it. And that's difficult for most people because we're not raised to be self-reliant and self-governing. We're raised to be dependent in all of our thinking and actions. So it's a hard step. You know, like when we, in our Republic assemblies in Canada, 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago now, we passed the first local bylaws banning COVID measures. We said in our communities, we nullify masking, distancing, shots, everything, because it goes against our health and our laws and our rights and everything, right? But then people couldn't enforce it. They couldn't imagine saying, okay, I'm going to enforce this now in our community. We're going to live according to our own laws, not these they're not even statutes. These dictates come in from health bureaucrats, right? I don't even call them health, but, you know, government and corporate bureaucrats. They couldn't imagine living according to their own power, their own creation, something different, right? A few can, but that's the biggest roadblock that we automatically defer to what is, to the status quo. And especially when you're under, and I know because as you probably heard, I underwent two chemical attacks during 2021.
Yes.
And it had the symptoms of cellulitis, severe staphylococcus infection. In fact, it was weaponry. I went on heavy antibiotics and that about kidney stones. I've got a very big one now. And the dilemma is it can only be taken up by surgery because it's too big, they say. I've looked at the x-rays and that. But I am not going into a hospital because lots of our people, especially natives, just never come out. You go into a hospital and you're dead, especially these days. So, you know, I'm realizing now it's a life and death issue for me that these alternatives exist, right? And as you know, doing something because your life depends on it is very different than doing something because you have a good intention.
Yeah.
It's a cause you picked up, right? Our lives depend on the creating these alternatives now. And so I think that that's something folks like you are very aware of, right? But it's communicating. if we can't communicate that to people, communication isn't just about language and finding the right words or expression. Communication is about your audience and their inability to hear you or to act on what they know. Even if they believe you, and we find this with the child killing thing, even if they believe you, they don't want to act on it. They don't want to believe it. It's too horrible. And they have to make too many risks and adjustments in their whole life, and they don't want to do that. So it's kind of a dilemma about how to communicate with the right people and try to build a base and an alternative. And that, to me, is the real challenge now.
Yeah. I have big feelings about the words that you just used. One of the ways that we express part of what you described is when we communicate with someone or multiple, the word multiple gets confusing in different usages. When we communicate with others in whatever way, we need to know that the energy of the necessity of what's in our communications, that the energy of it goes somewhere, because there are so many mechanisms that are embedded in environments to stop our energy, our communications, right, before it gets anywhere. And I mean, that's a function of trafficking being so ubiquitous in all our environments, which is very challenging for people to come to terms with. Yeah. We've been for a long time, since before anything was called COVID, we have been at intersections where we get treated abusively with plausible deniability in medical contexts. We are extracted from, we are experimented on, and we come from so many different walks of life. But as soon as we have been exposed to the stories about what all these different communities are experiencing, we recognize one another. And we didn't have the privilege before of being able to communicate with one another even that much. We didn't know that one another was there. We were all being damaged and traumatized continuously in ways that wipe out the person. The person is destroyed over and over and over again. And then somehow we're still here instead of dead. But these are death experiences that people are having. And, you know, it happens everywhere in communities, in rooms of houses, in rooms of buildings, in, you know, the house down the street, or like there's all this stuff that goes on where people don't really imagine that happening. But when we built the disability aid that is the Intuitive Community Network, when we decided to stop using tool sets that were co-opted by traffickers like Facebook, and we started building bridges to platforms like Telegram, which, while it is not, you know, essentially, totally, definitely trustworthy, Telegram gives us disability aid tool sets and does not use the same monetization practices that Facebook does. And so we've been able to more reliably communicate on Telegram for now and build infrastructure there that is disability aid infrastructure that means we can find one another and can communicate with one another and can communicate with a greater collective strength and say, hey, we are all experiencing this. We need you to listen to survivors in your communities. You won't allow trafficking to go on anymore if you're listening to survivors in your communities. If you need help understanding what survivors are saying, we are all here to help us understand one another. And that's really big. And if more people can understand that that's possible, you and I and so many other people would not have to engage in this. It's like really hardcore efforts to reach any kind of care as regards health. And that's in a world that's filled with poisons and filled with dangers right now because they've compounded. So it could be so much better. And maybe someone will take my ramble to heart. We need this conversation to be public. We need more people to come closer and say, well, what is really going on here? How can I be more in contact with the people who are ready to talk about it? Because there are so many.
Yeah, and so many survivors don't even have a name for what they've been through. They don't even have an acknowledgement in themselves that it's happened, right?
And often people are being intentionally deprived of the languaging that would allow them to even conceptualize what's really happening to them. I mean, words being magic in all of these ways that they are.
And I remember
using that.
It was right after I was fired from the church, United Church, in spring of 1996. And I was invited to one of the early healing circles, they call them. And that's a misnomer right there. A healing, you know, the word healing is a political term. It, you know, to the dominant society that did the crime, healing means ignore it, put it, bury it in legal jargon, suppress the evidence, remove any liability. That's what healing means, right? And shut up. The survivors have basically like to shut up, take their check, take the gag order and be quiet about it. And don't name names. I mean, that's, so we changed the name to healing, to simply sharing. Sharing circle. These were Native people who had been through the death camps that they call residential schools, right? And they weren't schools at all because they never got education. They were just internment camps where half of them died en masse, right? Murdered. And which, by the way, is a higher death rate than in the death camps in Europe.
Right.
During World War II. Because the death camps under Hitler were work camps as well. But the what they call residential schools were extermination centers where half the kids never came back. And so when you got the survivors of that in a room, the first problem is no one wanted to talk. And when they talked, they used the language they've been given. So the first thing I said to them was, forget about all these words. Speak from your heart what happened to you and find your own words. And it took a long time for even one person to break the ice. And one guy finally broke and said, they were trying to wipe us out. They tortured me. And that's not a word that has ever been used anywhere in relation to these Indian death camps, right? Ever. They use the word abuse. This mild sanitized term. Abuse can mean, you know, you've abused our relationship. You're using abusive language. It's this broad nothing word instead of torture, murder, sterilization, you know, psychiatric experimentation, all of this stuff. It's cleaned out. And so he said, when he said tortured, people broke down. They started crying. They began to moan. It kind of opened a door for people. Unfortunately, some people had been pre-programmed to kill themselves. And so you saw people in the group go off and kill themselves after because, you know, they were triggering that programming, right? But others went through it. And those are the ones who helped build our first campaign that forced some of this out into the open, right? But it started there in the sharing circle where they felt safe. And I said, look, you're here to speak what was true, right? True, that your truth that cannot be denied, but you can't deny to yourself first, right? Because that's how we're controlled by the cop in our head, not by a cop out there, right? And you've got to get rid of that cop and just speak what is true, regardless of the cost to you or anyone. The truth has to be spoken, right? And that a few were able to do that, right? Most weren't, but those few led the others. and really, you know, created that miracle where a few dozen of us finally got the country to admit that these things had happened, even forced the Pope to resign, right, in 2013. I mean, it create the truth has that power. It's like a snowball, right? It just keeps going. And they always want to divert it and melt it and reduce it with dead language. And that's how they do it primarily. So that to me, it's our own language is essential. Without it, we're lost, right?
Cliff High, I don't know if you've ever run across his work, but he talks about a lot of different subjects, including history. And he was talking about the Codex Werelinda. And he was talking about these passages in it, this really, really ancient text. And I think it's Frisian, but I'm not sure of my words around it. But what he was talking about was the name stealers. There was these ancient ancient passages talking about the dangers of name stealers and name stealing and the co-optation of words and language to trick or to mean something else or to claim something that's not true and then rely on that to cause all kinds of other damage, which we're really experiencing so much when it comes to language.
Okay, that's a good place to start, the whole idea of a name, because name is equated with identity and it isn't. A name, if you look at the root of the word, mm-hmm. it comes from a Hebrew word originally, but was Romanized. And it meant a name was the plaque you hang on a slave to say who owns them. That was your name. Okay, so don't forget, in the Bible, God says, or again, don't even use the word God because it's a label, but the Almighty, who are the Eternal One, or whatever the great mystery, as Native people say, the one with no name, says, I have no name. I am what I am. So call me I am. Okay, so that divine essence within all of us has no name, and it never should have a name. It's like when you have an experience, you can't describe it because it's sacred, or it's so horrible. It doesn't have language. That's the point. You reach a limit in language, right? And then there's just eternity. It's like, so we can't be guided into name language because our identity is independent of any name ever given to us. And, you know, the government ID, that's all capitalized letter. That's not even you. That's the corporate fiction.
Right. Created. I'm so glad that you're bringing that up. I don't want to cut you off, though.
No, go ahead.
Things are happening in my brain. So we've been talking recently with Robert Michael, who talks about law and the systems of entrapment that have been created around all of us. And I think that there may, I don't know if there's a disagreement or not between you and him. You may not even know each other. About common law. He's talking about something different. He says, be careful of common law because of this. And we haven't been able to quite figure out those details, but we're following his work and we're following your work in the different ways that those are manifesting. And so for instance, we've been trying to follow the Republic of Canada, wanting to participate, not quite knowing how, but a big part of this whole overarching conversation is that the things that we're putting into medical paperwork are re-securing the entrapment over and over again as we identify with the avatar in the predatory system that we're supposed to think is us, but actually requires our living consent to something. And it's so hard for severely disabled circumstances, trying left hemisphere damage. I don't even know how we've been doing this, but I'm so glad anytime anybody brings it up and your work on that subject through the Republic of Canada, the bits and pieces that we've been able to reach have been really important to us. So like, I'm really into having that conversation all the time.
Yeah, it's really I don't like to use the word, but it is spiritual politics. It's like, it's a recognition of the unseen. And the thing that has no expression, but it because it only expresses itself naturally through our existence. Okay, so when people get into a disagreement over the language, common law, natural law, that's an artificial debate, because we're basically talking about the same thing, the essence of us. Like in the American Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And the word unalienable, those are beautiful words because it expresses the essence of us. We know something innately. It's self-evident to us that we're self-governing, born free, born independent, not subject to any authority, right? Okay, so nothing can be alienated from us. Even if we think we've alienated, it's never alienated from us. It's soul, right? And we may be brainwashed to think that we've surrendered our essence, but we never have. We're living in this their illusion all the time, thinking that their lie has substance, and it doesn't. In the Bible, the word for an idol, you know, like most Bible in the Old Testament is filled with God just condemning his chosen people for worshiping idols all the time, right? But what he's the what that that's talking about, an idol, idol in Hebrew means nothing. There's nothing there. And it's funny because when I went to Rome to do that exorcism in 2009, I didn't plan on doing it, but when I was there, I kind of did it. I was standing there outside.
I would love it. I would tell that story while you're on the subject.
Yeah. Okay. Well, okay. Some background. I got invited to Italy in late 2009 to give talks there. The political parties there wanted to bring in a motion condemning Canada for genocide. But then they realized it was talking about the Vatican, so they all backed off because the Catholic Church funds all the political parties there and in most countries in the world. So, but I went there anyway with some people, and I wanted to do a ceremony at St. Peter's Square for all the victims of the Catholic Church, especially Native children in Canada. I had brought soil from a mass grave of children at the Mission Catholic Indian School on the West Coast, Canada. And I was going to do a ceremony there, and I'm standing there, and then I realized, wait a minute, I'm standing in the heart of the beast here. I can't pass up this opportunity. And it just came over me, I should really call out this entity. It's really like an exorcism to call it out. And when you, the first stage of a exorcism is you get it to name itself. Okay, name. When you name it, it loses its power when it's forced to name itself, right? So it was, I did it there. And it's funny because in St. Peter's Square, you're not allowed to hold any kind of religious ceremony or political protest. You can't even walk around with a T-shirt with a slogan on it, or they arrest you. The Vatican police and the Rome police arrest you, anyone who tries that. That had happened to a group of Native elders who had come there the year before, and they got arrested for performing a pagan ceremony, right? So, yeah, so there I was. I got my regalia on, some Native stuff. I got the dust, the remains of the children. And I start talking, and they're ignoring me. They're walking by me like I'm invisible. You know, I knew at that point that there was strong, and I felt it. There was like strong protection around me. And I called this thing out. I did the first stage of an exorcism, which I've done on other occasions. I've taken part in them on a couple of occasions in Canada, on the West Coast among the natives. And the next morning, a tornado hits the center of Rome. This was October 10th, 2009. I'm sorry, I did it on the 11th. It was October 12th, 2009. And this tornado goes bang, hits the center of Rome the first time in 40 years. And that same week, this was when Pope Benedict was in, Joseph Ratzinger, the media started reporting that same week about his personal role in covering up child trafficking and killing in the Catholic Church. And he eventually, in our court case, we forced him out of office, right? So, but that broke the back right there, right? And I was realizing there's this greater power operating through us all the time that has no name, but you have to stand in its presence and let it do act through you. And then all of the kind of illusions and lies fall away. It has no power over it because idle, it's nothing. And when I was standing there in St. Peter's Square, I shut my eyes. I expected to be overwhelmed by the place, right? About its evil and the whole history around it and everything, because it's built right on the site where Emperor Caligula had his palace and torture centers. And the pillars of St. Peter's Square are taken from the Colosseum, where people were slaughtered en masse. So the whole energy was horrible. It's this dark satanic energy, the heart of Rome. And yet I'm standing there, I shut my eyes, and I feel like there's nothing there. I felt like I was standing in front of a big hole that had nothing in it. Okay. And I think that was accurate because there's nothing. It's a big, almost like a hologram. And I could say that about the whole society. And learning about who we really are means stepping out of the illusion back into reality. And that's really the genuine spiritual path is when we do that in ourselves. It's here, it's nowhere else, right? But that's the road to recovery. And not everybody is able to do that. I don't think a lot are, but there is a minority who are. And when they do that, I mean, look what happened. There's only a few of us. Bang, we force all of this stuff out. We force popes to resign because we were part of this kind of wave that I don't have a name for, but the powers of the world have no authority over it. It's its own authority. And when we talked about setting up the republic, we set it up on that sovereign basis. The spiritual sovereignty, the inner personal sovereignty within us leads to political sovereignty, right? And that's the whole idea. So just in closing, I know that was long, but other people, it's not a matter of fighting over different interpretations of what common law is. We all know what it is innately. And other people call it natural law. The natives call it law of the land. But we're all talking about the same thing, the thing that precedes everything in the human world. It's who we are, self-governing, the law that does harm to no one, the law of nature, you know, that has no authority or oppression of one over another. And, you know, the world was given for us to share together. And like all of that, that innate understanding is within all of us. And we go right up against its opposite every time we try to live this in the world. And that's why we always have to begin but from that inner knowing, right? So I'll stop, but that's kind of in a nutshell.
It's important stuff. There are two things I want to ask you, and being mindful of the time and hoping that we get the chance to do this again in the future. I'm certainly planning on it, and we're praying for really good things to happen for all of us and for yourself so that we can continue these conversations. I think that one of these things that I would like to say is knowing that the Republic of Kanata is being participated in internationally, not only in so-called Canada. We in our network we consist of a lot of really isolated people. So finding more people in one place has been really challenging. We're looking for ways to participate, but we haven't seen how it can happen yet. And reading like with our eyes is really difficult. Like you have all these wonderful books and I've been able to get through some of them, but it's like, oh, I need better conditions for my eyeballs to function in order to do it. And it's such crucial material. And I want to give people an idea of how from severely disabled and isolated circumstances, how can we somehow inspire in our communities more participation in this directly?
Well, it starts believing in yourself and believing in what you can do. And some of us have had the advantage of living through a lot of trauma and come up the other end. And so we know that nothing can overcome us. But there's always the fear that holds us back in that, like, who am I? I'm just this one man or woman. And there's nobody around me in my community. But it doesn't matter. You start anyway, and you apply these ideas right where you are, right? And it starts by holding, not over the internet, face to face. It's the face to face contact is essential, and that's a microcosm. Often we form little cells of 2, 3, 4 people first, and then enough of those get together, and you hold an assembly, which can pass laws. You sign a charter. You're a governing body, right? But the people have to know each other first and be familiar. Otherwise, they get infiltrated and disrupted. That's what took down a lot of our assemblies, right? And people fall out. They've got, if you just call a meeting, people come in with all sorts of levels of knowledge and commitment and all that stuff. And so we need to build from the grassroots. Like any, you know, in any good community organizing, you start from the grassroots and go up. But it means familiarity with yourself and with the people around you. Like in The Art of War, Sun Tzu says that all the time. He said, if you don't know your enemy and you don't know yourself, you lose every battle. But if you know both, you'll win every battle. If you really know your enemy and its nature and know yourself and your own nature, you can't lose. And that's borne out all the time. That's been borne out on what I've been doing and other people around me. And so it's starting where you are and giving people the resources to do that and the encouragement. So communicating like this regularly and not doing something once or 10 times, but for the rest of your life, you take a new direction in your life and you stay at it and you stay at it. And the advantage of that is you learn and you make mistakes, which is your best teacher. You know, the two best teachers are a black eye and a mistake because when you're being hit by the system, you know it, you know, it's all the unclarity gets blown away. And when you make a mistake, you learn from it and you don't do it the next time. But if you're only dabbling in an issue and are gone to another issue no more, you never learn those lessons, right? So yeah, it's consistency and forming a core leadership of some kind, even one other person, and then building out from there and trusting each other. That's something, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s and I was involved in movements, this is before the internet, before computers, you'd put up a poster and call a meeting, 200 people would show up and the serious people would stay and you knew each other because you did everything together all the time. So you know who to trust and who not to. You can't tell over the internet or from an email anything about the person, right? You only learn that through contact. Again, Sun Tzu says, familiarity, contact with each other and with your enemy is the best teacher, because it's only by encountering something or someone that you learn its nature, right? And so I would say the close physical contact is essential for building anything solid, because the internet gives the illusion that sharing information equals knowledge equals doing something, and it doesn't. It can often be very misleading, right? You know, doing something means personal growth and changing the situation around you through your own direct action and contact with others. And we can facilitate that with information, but that's the big job. And I think these generations post, you know, 1990, they don't know anything else but internet kind of information-based knowledge. And it's only one small sliver of our total broad human spectrum of knowledge and wisdom, you know, and we got to get back to that. So I would say, yeah, helping people form local groups and eventually uniting those, that's where it begins.
So I want to call out also, like, well, I mean, my final question, I think, for this hour is about how we go from that place, from recognizing the way that we can overcome fear around, like, oh, well, I can't do this. How could I possibly do this? Of course, we're being beset by messaging that tells us we can't do it in environments full of neurotoxins that are shown to make people more vulnerable to suggestion. So like, there's a reason for the feeling of that onslaught. And we want people to find in themselves the courage and, I don't know, confidence, self-assurance, to be able to say, well, I want my environments to be safe. I want my communities to be real. I want my family to thrive in an environment full of thriving multi-generational families. How do we take the steps towards doing that? And one of the things that I want to call out as we move in that direction is that people are feeling so much ambient fear that they're only feeling that fear. Like, they don't know what it is. They don't want to call it fear. You know, it's something else. It's stress, or it's just like, I'm quiet today, or like whatever somebody's saying. But essentially, there's a fear thing going on. There's a, like, what will happen if I do this thing, or what will happen if I say this thing? And the reason that people are feeling that so much is because of the environmental targeting that's going on through all of these different entrainment technologies and policies that have been set so that people mistreat one another. And so, like, if we are listening to trafficking survivors, and if we are refusing to allow trafficking pathways to operate in our environments, that ambient fear just disappears because it's being actively perpetuated by the stuff that people are not addressing. So when we choose together to address those things and have the challenging conversations and learn about law and how, you know, legality has been misused.
Okay, so let's start with fear. Some anecdotes. My biggest fear after I got fired was losing my children. And I did everything possible to avoid that, but I lost them. I lost daily contact with them. And I went through that fear and came out the other and said, I'm still here. I'm still seeing them. The fear was a worry about what might happen, not it was a what if, not what is. So we have to shift the thinking from what if to what is. Okay. Our self-concern is what holds us back. What might happen to me if I do this? When the focus shifts to what might happen to the ones I love if I don't do something, then the fear dissipates. Here's an example. I was one night in the downtown part of Vancouver in the slum area. The cops had beaten up and grabbed one of the people in our group. His name was Trevor. They had him inside the lockup on Main Street. And all of a sudden, all these homeless Native people converged from everywhere. And there was this old woman, Maggie. Most of the time you would see her drunk out of her mind lying on the street corner. But there was Maggie facing 25 riot cops who had gathered outside the police station in Vancouver. And she was dragging a police barrier across Main Street to stop traffic. And she was screaming, pointing at these riot cops, "You let Trevor go now," right? And these cops didn't know what to do because in the face of her energy, they were just standing there like, what do we do with this old woman who's yelling at us? And we did that. We all went out and we sat down on Main Street and we didn't move. And an hour later, they let him go, right? Instead of beating our brains out. And the reason they didn't is because it's like in Native culture. I don't know if you've seen in movies where Native people in battle, warriors would count coup. There was a long stick, a coup stick. And they would run up in the middle of a battle, unarmed, with only the coup stick, and hit their enemy, and then ride away. And by doing that, he would take the power of the enemy away. Because they would say, look, I'm braver than you are. I'm unarmed, and I'm braver than you. So who's won? Right? Even if you kill me, I've won. I've taken your energy. And so we've done that all the time. We counted coup against the system. We occupied Catholic churches in spring of 2008. A month later, the government starts apologizing and starts about healing, about the residential schools. We did that. We counted coup because we walked in there like Maggie did that night. She was unafraid. Okay. When our love and our outrage overcomes our fear of what might happen to us, it's like in battle, you find that there's the green soldiers. And the first time the troops are in battle, they break and run. But the veterans hold them in place. The guys who have been there under fire, they know, and they lead the others back. And that's the situation we're in. The veterans have to show by example, look, I've been through hell and back. I know that we have the power here. We don't have to break and run according to our own fear. So what we keep in mind is always, what's going to happen if we don't act? What's going to happen to our children and the ones who love and the people we know about right now are suffering and dying, right? And are being targeted. If we don't act, they're dead. If we don't act, we're dead, right? So bring it on. I mean, what's the worst they can do to me? I thought that later. Okay, they've taken my kids. They've destroyed my life. It's like that homeless woman, Maggie. What else could they do to her? They've taken everything from her. What does she have to lose? We have nothing left to lose. It's only when you think you've got something to lose that you get afraid, right? And that's the biggest thing. So we shouldn't hold people back from losing, from going through an experience where things are taken from us, because that's how we learn. That's how we get stronger. At least the remnant who are meant to be the veterans to lead the others, right? It's a necessary phase we need to go through. So I think the whole thing of fear is like an idol. It's an illusion, but it's cured and practiced by our heart getting stronger than up here, which our brains, our right brain, or is that the left? I can never figure it. It's the left brain that's the rational part, right?
The left rational, yes.
Okay, so that's how we're controlled through our left brain.
We're trained to be controlled through our left brain in a lot.
Right, okay, better. Yeah. Yes, you're right. So it's discovering our totality of who we are and not being confined to that, easily targeted by energy, weaponry, everything, that part of us. We have resources, and we proved this in practice, we have the resources to overturn, to create the world anew, like the American Founding Fathers said, right? And we have it within our power to create the world anew. Thomas Paine said that in Common Sense, written in Valley Forge in winter when the Continental Army had shrunk to 2,000 men. He said, doesn't matter, we've won. We're going to defeat the British, the biggest empire in the world, because we know we're going to win, because we have liberty and the human destiny in our hands. And America is the only country in the world that ever put that in a founding document. We have no sovereigns. The people are sovereign. The people can rule themselves. And that idea is so beautiful because it's summed up that spiritual reality, that we're self-governing expressions of the divine, right? And America has a sacred task to recover that, you know, because it's being thrown away, and we have to recover that dream and live it again. And that's really what this is all about. Kind of, an, you know, when you boil it down, we're recovering that revolution.
Yeah, there's all this stuff that is said all the time, but do we really mean it? And are we as aligned with the words we allow to be used as we think we are? And if we can be better at that, how much better are all our lives? Like, we don't have to shrug off the violence anymore. We can say, well, no more violence. We don't have to do it. I want to make sure that people remember that they can support you by visiting. There are three websites. I hope I have them accurately coming out of my mouth. I'm pretty sure I do. Republicofcanada.ca, and that's K-A-N-A-T-A, Republicofcanada.ca. Murderbydecree.com and BBSRadio/HereWeStand.
BBSRadio.com.
BBSRadio.com/HereWeStand. I got it. Right. Thank you for doing what you do and broadcasting what you broadcast. It really means a lot to us.
Well, it means a lot to talk to you, and especially to everyone, you know, who is on the front line and fighting what seems to be a hopeless battle, but it isn't hopeless, because those are the ones that are the most important, right? For the people that you don't see, right? And so I think that's, we've got to take courage and strength from each other, you know.